Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, and welcome to the New Books Network in East Asian Studies podcast series. I'm Subi Rautio, one of the hosts of the channel, and today I will be speaking with Charlotte Brookerman about her new book, Claiming Homes, Confronting Domicide in Rural China, published by Bergen Books in October 2019. Charlotte Brookerman's new book is the works of years of research studying how Chinese citizens make themselves at home despite economic transformation, political rupture, and domestic dislocation in the contemporary countryside. Through her writing, she eloquently describes how villagers confront the planned and deliberate destruction of their homes, also known as domicide. Delving into the political, historical, economic, sensorial, and kinship claims to their homes, Charlotte's book is an insightful contribution to studies on contemporary China and anthropology, but also for anyone interested in domicide and more generally, discussions on dispossession and dislocation. Charlotte, welcome to the program.
Thanks. I'm really pleased to be here. Hi, Subi.
We're pleased to have you as well. So let's start the discussion by perhaps you could first tell us and our audiences a bit about yourself. How did you first get involved in anthropology in China? And how did you end up in your field site sweeping the Lijian Shanxi province?
So I actually studied anthropology already as an undergraduate at the School of Oriental and African Studies in London at SOAS. And during that time there, I took the regional ethnography course of China, and I was particularly fascinated of the sort of configuration of it being both a sort of capitalist center and also with this continued communist leadership. And it was that contradiction that really intrigued me, as well as the fact that I really enjoyed how the anthropology of China, partly due to the hiatus that occurred in many of the studies during the Maoist period, had a very recent and very sort of vibrant and emerging academic field. And when I finished my undergraduate degree, I had a friend from Hong Kong who told me that he was going to Beijing to study Mandarin. He's a Cantonese speaker. And I thought, great, what a great idea. And so I actually moved with him to Beijing and did an intense year of language study. And upon my return to the UK, continued on with a master's at Oxford that then led to the formulation of my PhD research. And I was very much interested in this intersection between homes, gender, generation, kinship in China. And I felt like this area had, in some ways, maybe because it was sort of dominated by structuralist theory, and particularly Claude Lévi-Strauss, as well as sort of Bourdieu's Kabul House and so forth, it had kind of been neglected in the anthropology of China because a lot of the theory that was coming from it was from an earlier age. And so I thought this would be a really interesting point at which to begin doing research. And I remember that when I got to Shanxi, within weeks, I thought, well, definitely the structuralist idea of the house as a kinship structure does not fit here, but it led me down a lot of very interesting pathways in terms of thinking about people's everyday practices and relations through these really everyday and practiced interrelations in the home. Now, Shanxi itself as a choice of field site was partly about that initial impulse. So I did as much research building up to the field work as possible. But in some ways, Shanxi was a little bit of a black box. But some of the factors that I did know was that it had this very extensive architectural heritage that came from the 19th century when it was a banking and merchant hub in the Chinese context. And that these Shanxi merchants, although they traveled very widely throughout the world, especially in their money lending and financial transaction business, built these extended sumptuous courtyard complexes in their rural homes. And this was something that I, you know, had found out beforehand, as well as that then in the 20th century, it had been dominated by a particular warlord, that he had done a lot of redistribution in ways that sometimes resembled even the Soviet Union, but also that that a lot of villagers had come to live in these sumptuous courtyard houses as they were redistributed, both by that warlord and then Yan Xishan, and then also subsequently during the Maoist era. So all of this deeply intrigued me, and I thought might be an ideal site because you've got this architectural heritage that people are living in who have a very different relationship to their historical path, to issues of wealth and finance, as well as to labor and industrial labor in particular. And that was something maybe a little bit I underestimated before actually getting access to the site, was just how strongly the local political economy was dominated by particularly the energy sector, because Shanxi has a lot of coal deposits. And as luck would have it, that is also actually how I managed to get an in to my field site. I spent quite a few months trying to get access. It was not the easiest feat, partly because there were quite a lot of corruption scandals and so forth that happened in Shanxi. And I think it was in many ways not in the interest of that many local power holders to have a foreigner living there long term, especially in the countryside, which was my intended goal. But I became very lucky that through a professor in Beijing who had students of sociology who were in Shanxi, I was sort of handed on to a librarian who then knew of a coal corporation that was trying to diversify its investment portfolio by developing tourism in the countryside in one of these sites that has these beautiful architectural buildings. And so I was introduced and we met and I discussed my plans. And I think this particular energy executive also sees himself as both sustaining and protecting important heritage, including intangible heritage, and also in fostering local development in diverse ways, also moving away from energy intensive uses of coal towards the service economy and so forth. I think he really saw that there could be benefits to having me be there and study what was going on in the village. And I was given a very generous, open field to go and live there and ask questions and write what I found. And I think it's been a really great cooperation for me, and I think also hopefully for them. I did do some translation work for them in the earlier stages. I mean, it also led to some tensions, especially around my intentions in the village in the early days of field work, when people didn't really know me very well and they were not entirely sure why I was asking them so many questions about their own personal history, the history of their homes and their houses, particularly as they were becoming concerned that given what coal corporations and energy corporations generally do in Shanxi when they want to foster development is that they relocate villagers into new high-rises. And this was a process that they were concerned about and ambiguous about how that would happen, what kind of compensation would happen, whether they would want to move at all. And actually, that did happen in the subsequent years. That was several years after I had left the village. And all of this I've sort of laid out in the book, which, of course, took many years to write. I've revisited the material many times, and I also revisited the village many times. And it's quite nice when I go back now, because in some ways it is also my Chinese home. Even when I go on field work elsewhere, I have a very special feeling of belonging in this particular village. So it's quite nice that sort of comes together with the theme of the book.
Oh, that's really quite touching. And as an anthropologist myself, it sounds that sense of belonging into your field site, but also because that is kind of the theme of your book, looking at you look at from so many different themes, so many different angles, how the people that you worked with and befriended form that sense of belonging. So it's really quite moving to hear that you also found that sense of belonging in the process. Some themes that you just brought up, I think, come out so clearly written in your book itself, especially in part one, where you delve into the historical and political relevance of how these lived spaces are allocated in Sweeping Cliff, but also in Shanxi province more broadly. And I really enjoyed reading about how you trace these historical patterns to look at the distribution and redistribution of property and wealth across the region. By doing so, you're able to shift the reader's attention from perceiving China's peripheral countryside as a homogenous space with a homogenous population to instead delve into the historically uneven trajectories of development in China. This adds to a much deeper level of understanding for the reader to consider what it means to be a peasant in contemporary China from the subject of claiming homes. Can you tell us a bit more about that? How does history and politics play in what you call confronting domicile in rural China today? So just now you gave us a really, really great understanding on the kind of historical relevance of where Shanxi stands with the architectural tradition. But could you expand a bit more on the notion of confronting domicile that comes out in your research?
Thanks. Yeah, I mean, so the notion of domicile I was more familiar with from the real estate and commercial developments that are happening in southeastern China, in the areas that develop very rapidly, very quickly, where real estate prices are soaring. You have such situations as in Shenzhen, where you have villages in the city and so forth, where the local government, in order to foster development, will allow for very rapid real estate and commercial housing to go up, and they have to relocate a lot of people who are often living in single or two-story housing there. And I thought, well, actually, that is a process that is happening in the countryside as well, in the sense that local governments have an interest in fostering development, and that it's justified in terms of the general good of the population, and that people then become dislocated and displaced. And in contrast to, say, in the urban setting, where there's often a promise of accumulation and incremental value happening from the real estate market prices that are already occurring. In Shanxi, it seems to me that there had to be a form of devaluation that went concurrently with this, saying that these things were not worth as much as people locally might claim that they are, in order to allow for the relocation to occur and in order for the compensation packages to be negotiated and so forth. So that's kind of how I came to this conception of domicide. But then, as you can actually see in the book, it's not, I also don't think of it as a single moment that's happened in the wake of the market reforms in China. But that actually, when you push back historically, and this came very much through the interviews that I was leading with families, you see that actually there's a much longer trajectory of dislocation and dispossession that people narrate when they talk about why they live where they live and who they belong to and why they belong to that place. And I'm thinking here of both the period under Yin Xishan, under the warlord that controlled Shanxi in the Republican era, and the kind of taxations that he did, but also the sort of local lineage structures so forth, and also property ownership that meant that people were moved around forcibly, forced mobility for all things of all sorts of aspects, such as adoption, marriage, but also labor. And simultaneously, they still managed to, you know, build up notions of home through their work, through their labor. And that you see this particularly strongly with the women who, despite marrying into another lineage, would bear and raise children and therefore create their sense of belonging to a new home and a new place. And that then there, again, that you had a sort of another period of domicide or rupture in the 1950s as housing was relocated. And for many people, this was quite an alienating experience. I mean, you had the class labels that were attached to them, and people were the houses, the courtyards, which were these grand courtyard complexes that used to belong to merchants, were separated into various bays. And then people who were considered particularly deserving were given access to prime real estate in the village. So you had people like Red Army veterans, former communist spies against the Kuomintang, or even local men who fought with the with the local Red Army forces, or became party members early on, and they were often living alongside people who had been classified as former landowners, or even their servants and other dependents. And this kind of led to a very interesting period of negotiation as well, where people had to sort of accommodate each other and their very divergent life paths under these new conditions. And then, of course, as I have focused on so far in the interview, this period from the 1980s onwards, as certain processes of industrialization and now even deindustrialization have again meant that people have to reorient their lives and their locale, and become to a certain extent also relocated. And this led me also to this idea that the home is really not necessarily just an architectural feature or physical structure, but very much entangled with people's emotional and affective ties and the way that they co-substantiate each other as persons, but also their relationship to the land, to the landscape, to the region more generally.
Yeah, absolutely. And that comes out so beautifully in part two of your book, in the ethnographic descriptions of family gatherings and celebrations that you write about and that you took part in. And here in part two, you focus more about on gender, generational divides, and kinship patterns in Sweeping Cliff and the people that you worked with. Is this something that you could this be something that you tell our audiences a bit more about? How do these themes play out in the making of homes? So just now you mentioned briefly gender. Could you please expand a bit on that? So the audience hears a bit more on how you write about gender, kin, and generational divides in part two of your book.
So I think that's very much the case, that people use these experiences where they come together and the stakes that they have, you know, in terms of belonging to each other and the stakes that they have over objects and things such as houses, but also other forms of material wealth, become really spectacularized in front of audiences. And I think that's something that I really enjoyed observing and also discussing with people at these family gatherings, from weddings and funerals towards the more unusual anthropological ritual of children's birthday parties. And I think for me, what was very interesting there was to not just focus on the political economy perspective on value. I mean, in the strictest Marxist sense, that would even be surplus labor value. But to think about value and sort of competing regimes of value that coexist. So you also have these kind of affective and ethical forms of attachment and forms of value that become implicated in these processes. And the way that I conceptualized that was, of course, on the one hand, the notion of jia, which is the house, home, and family, thereby sort of bridging as a concept in Chinese the idea of a location, a place, and the people that one belongs to. And thinking about how this is entangled with notions of work, labor, and care. And here I really was following my informants, following people in the village in terms of the way that they would discuss family and kinship, as well as notions of gender and generation, as a form of mutual support and mutual cooperation that really involved labor that would sustain one another. And I mean, on the one hand, there's this political economy side that actually nicely dovetails with the effective and ethical dimensions. So the idea that the jia is not just a local phenomenon, but can be scaled all the way up to the Chinese nation. So you have the guojia, the country home, the country or nation home, which is the entire nation. But that you have both ideas about belonging, about competing value, including the competing value of persons, as well as moments where there are actually violent ruptures and exclusions that happen around who belongs. And I think one of the favorite topics, because it was a bit more cheerful and playful than some of the other dynamics I observed in the village, were the presence of these children's birthday parties, where you actually found different generations and genders of people trying to show that they were belonged to, or that the offspring belonged to them. And of course, this, you know, ties in nicely with the family planning policy, where you have increasingly just one grandchild to two parents and four grandparents. And when they have these big festivities, the way that they try to spectacularize who belongs to them and where the lines of belonging fall, and that you actually find particularly with maternal grandmothers and women, that in contrast to this, you know, classic notion of Chinese kinship completely focused on the patriline, there are these other forms of creating ties between women that are being sort of not just re-instantiated at these birthday parties, but really put on the central stage and really celebrated in a big way. While sometimes you'll even find that the lineage elders are sort of inside the home doing their ancestral worship while women and their mothers are outside in the courtyard in front of all these onlookers, showing that they belong to one another also through these maternal ties. So these are the kind of micro-political maneuverings that you see in terms of who belongs to whom, who is allowed to claim what from whom, and so forth. As the demographic changes, but also political economic changes interact with people's affective and emotional conceptions of value and belonging.
Oh, that's really fantastic. And it really does come out in your writing, this notion, which is relatively kind of common sense in anthropology, that kinship and relations, you know, requires work, requires it's a social reproduction rather than something that you're just born into. And the excitement of these birthday parties really does come out in your writing, and the pictures that you provide of these grandsons with the qualia, the round bread, the wreath bread that they, you know, these pictures you have of these adorable round grandsons, and then the massive bread that's that kind of that the grandmother is holding up. But you also really do a fantastic job at kind of tracing which grandmother is present. So is it the maternal or the paternal grandmother? And just now you were talking about this kind of this performance they put on to claim this kind of access to that grandchild really comes out through your writing. Something I should have asked maybe at the beginning of this recording, but you mentioned in your book just now, because I'm talking about these pictures that you have in your book itself, these pictures that you've taken during your field work, and you do mention at the beginning of claiming homes that your interlocutors, the people that you befriended, if I understood correctly, they were kind of grown close. They grew closer to you once they realized your photography skills. So that must have been really a merit that you brought to your field work, and they must have really appreciated that you did document these really quite lavish and fantastic family gatherings.
Yeah, that was definitely one of my ways in, was through the playing the role of the village photographer. So sometimes I would be invited to events, and then almost as an offhand aside, they'd say, but make sure you bring your camera, particularly because this kind of this form of the snapshot. I mean, people were using their mobile phones to do that, but most people didn't actually have cameras to take good photographs of spontaneous events. So having a good camera for that, and then also generally going around to people's houses afterwards, bringing these photographs, but also then using the photographs to ask a couple of questions about who was this again and what was going on here, was actually an incredibly helpful tool.
Absolutely.
In a home.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think in your final chapter, if we move on to the last part three of your book, in your final chapter, you really expand more on these kind of online forums and the technology that allowed for communication beyond this kind of location where you were based in Shanxi. And it also just adds so much more depth to people who aren't anthropologists who are listening to this podcast. It reminds the reader and listeners now that there's so much more depth to the role of ethnographer, that the levels of access that you were able to obtain through your research, both kind of in a very personal, intimate level with the rural citizens, but then also kind of going beyond that to understand conversations online. And of course, your conversations with government officials and Chinese citizens of different ranking who were all come together in this location of the sweeping cliff. So my question about part three refers more to the themes of labor, location, and precarity that you draw on in part three of your book. And your final chapter starts with the description of the panic of an approaching earthquake. And it's really gripping to read because basically you are, and the people around you are, suddenly in this state of emergency. And you write about this fear that settles across both you and the wider population. And what I really enjoyed about this was that you were able to look at this context of the panic of an earthquake as a direct confrontation to reconsider where people around you were reconsidering and voicing concerns about the state's role in guaranteeing housing safety for its citizens. And you, so therefore, you're looking at the panic kind of as a window to understand a much wider distrust that Chinese people share towards the government's limitations to care for its people in a state of emergency. Maybe you could tell us a bit more about that event. How did the people you lived with and befriended in Shanxi respond to this false alarm of disaster that came close to placing your lives at a very serious threat?
Thanks. Yeah, that was a very dramatic moment. This was during the New Year's period in 2010 when everybody, all migrants were back home in their rural and urban families and so forth. And we really had a very dramatic event where this, I was staying with a friend in the city overnight, and her mother came in really at 3 a.m. or something and woke us up and said, an earthquake is coming, get out of bed, be ready for when the building collapses. And the entire city was kind of abuzz with people taking emergency warnings into their own hands. So people were setting off leftover firecrackers and fireworks from the New Year's period. People were honking, sirens were going off. And there was also not just that kind of soundscape of emergency, but there was also simultaneously a lot of phone calls being made. People were on online messaging boards spreading information and so forth. And this real fear that gripped the entire locale, to the point that a neighbor from the village told me that her uncle, who's a mountain shepherd, who was up in the mountains with his sheep overnight, was alerted to this on foot by another neighbor. And people actually started moving from the city in the dead of night with their cars and on foot up into the villages and so forth, because they became so fearful that this had happened, that an earthquake was going to come. And I think it did really very much speak to these general ideas about the limits of the government's capacity to care for the people in an emergency, and sort of wider distrust in the credibility of both official and unofficial forms of information. And I mean, on the one hand, this is something to do with the way that, you know, new events, crisis events emerge, in which there is no past event that compares directly. So forms of prediction become extremely hard. And you have this kind of almost prophetic idea, these prophecies that of what is to come start to emerge. But also people grasp at any form of information, especially sort of horizontal forms of information from people that they trust. And this was sort of very much alive during this moment. And the way that the government clamped down on the distribution of information through unofficial channels unfolded also led to certain conspiracy theories, I would even say, that this was actually a government experiment, because there had been some tests at fire stations and also at local hospitals to prepare for the possibility of an earthquake, as well as the way that the government responded by then saying, oh, well, it wasn't these official tests, that's just rumors. And then they went and found online bloggers and said that these people in the internet had spread rumors, and thereby sort of tried to discredit sort of people-to-people information sharing and so forth. And actually, on people's mobile phones, there was also a government message that said, you know, people don't have the right to share information that's not about earthquakes, that's not accredited by the official earthquake bureau. So all of these issues sort of came together around ideas about this this particular region having faced a lot of devaluation and dispossession that wasn't really being recognized by the government, and that this played out in the field of reproduction. And I think for many people, their homes, their housing is one of those places where they most experience that that form of dispossession and devaluation in terms of reproduction, because it's so central to personal continuity. And I mean, I think there are certain parallels that we now also see emerging with COVID-19 and the way that people try to strive to make sense of a situation of crisis by interacting with official and governmental forms of information, but also by taking matters into their own hands and spreading communication in ways that allow them to find their own pathways in a kind of disaster or crisis situation.
Yeah, thank you. That's really really fascinating to listen to you. And just as you were talking, this the number of parallels that I think our listeners could pull on what's been happening in obviously China, but also outside of China in relation to COVID-19. But I wanted to conclude our conversation, to move closer to your current work, which also, to my understanding, looks at looks at a crisis, but of a very different kind, the environmental crisis. And I'm aware that you're studying themes on environment and ecological transformation in China in your postdoctoral research as part of the Frontlines of Value project at the University of Bergen. And even in your Claiming Homes book, which was conducted, the fieldwork was conducted 10 years ago, if I'm not mistaken, you're already writing about pollution, and there's several moments in your chapters where you refer to this kind of stifling pollution that lures over the landscape of Sweeping Cliff. So obviously the context of Shanxi and the kind of industrial development in the region, you were talking to people and probably experiencing this kind of environmental degradation. But perhaps I should let you talk more about this rather than me telling you what my interpretations of the book. Could you talk a bit more about your recent research? And in particular, how do you perceive the transition from studying homes and domicile in rural China to focusing on the environment?
Thanks. Yeah, I mean, so the current research really builds on environmental concerns that were very much present in 2009, 2010, and in subsequent years, but were very much not explicitly and discursively addressed. So one of the things that I found in Shanxi was that people had a whole host of everyday practices and even habits that were unspoken, that were, for instance, tried to reduce the inhalation of dust because they knew it was so dangerous. And another element that I sort of observed or participated in terms of my fieldwork in the earlier periods were also the way that people understood the devaluation of industrial labor and the sort of reproductive risks that went around the physical collapsing of mines, as well as mining closures and the loss of labor from that. So that kind of already set up this issue, this programmatic of people having the risk of environmental degradation and the kind of health consequences that carried with it, as well as the parallel fear of further devaluation of their labor and dispossession of their means of production. And I think those things really came together for me during the years following fieldwork, and it started to sort of coalesce into a much stronger motivation to look at environmental crisis in China, as well as the solutions that people are trying to find across the country. And on the one hand, I return regularly to Shanxi to discuss these issues there, and particularly through the reorientation of the energy and mining sector and the attempts to create this low carbon civilization in the region, through things that are already in the Claiming Homes book, like tourism development and other forms of deindustrialization, investment into real estate and so forth. But also, I've been looking at a number of broader policy changes that are happening at the higher up levels of the state in China, and particularly Xi Jinping's promises to instantiate an ecological civilization through promoting low carbon life, and what this means for citizens on the ground, and how there are also local projects that try to live up to these aspirations. So I've done field work with foresters in Fujian who are planting trees in order to integrate into the local carbon market, as well as some of the mobile phone-based solutions through the planting of e-trees that happens. So the most prominent of these is provided by Alipay, which has a number of which has a large number of users throughout China, of course. And the thing is, what many people don't realize is that in addition to having a credit and a cash account, every user is also issued with a carbon account. And this carbon account actually allows people to accumulate carbon savings, and then a small virtual tree plants that they can then have actually planted in the desert. And I've also gone on field work in Gansu, where people are actually planting these trees in the desert, and but also trace these chains back to friends that I have back in Shanxi. So a friend who works at a coal washing station and sought from me actual evidence that these trees were being planted in Gansu, that I should take pictures, ideally of her very own trees, and send them back to her and so forth. And the way that these new material technological changes are coalescing with understandings about crisis and people's capacities to facilitate change in China are really central to what I've been doing more recently. But yes, it very strongly comes from this experience that I had in Shanxi as one of the, as a region that, you know, experienced a kind of heroic position as the vanguard of industrialization through its role in the energy policy, and has subsequently been recast as a place that relies on outmoded forms of heavy industry and the polluting forms of coal in order to drive development. And what that does, both in terms of the understandings that people in Shanxi have of themselves, but also how these kinds of inside and outside perspectives on a place, from Shanxi all the way up to China, and even, you know, humanity as a whole in terms of this environmental crisis, play out. So yeah, I definitely see that there's continuity, although I'm hoping that I'm sort of moving on and developing also some new approaches. You mentioned that there's the Frontlines of Value group that I'm part of at the University of Bergen. And I think that's something that's very much analytically and theoretically been very, very helpful for me, is working with a group and talking about different forms of value that are emerging. I mean, something that was already in the book was bringing together ideas about production and reproduction, particularly from a Marxist understanding, with ideas of kinship and belonging, and even sort of ritual studies and religion and so forth. And I think that's something that has, in my work more recently, become more theoretically crystallized around this concept of value and how we can connect forms of political and economic value, and also devaluation and dispossession that happen, particularly around reproductive work, with these broader dynamics of affect, experience, of emotional ties, and these sort of ideas about even the way that, for instance, during a time of crisis, a certain sensibility or mood can take hold, both in terms of a locale or in terms of a group of people, or even as we've seen now with this global crisis in the last few months, can even take on a sort of sweeping character that actually goes around the world, also partly facilitated by the technological and material forms of connection that we're now able to make across vast distances. So yes, I see that there's kind of a pathway that I've been following and I'm sort of hoping to pursue and deepen in the coming years.
Thank you, Charlotte. It's so fascinating just now as you were talking. I can definitely see those continuities that, and it's really fantastic to hear how much you're expanding from all the research and everything you've learned that's formed in your books, in your book, Claiming Homes, Confronting Domicide in Rural China. And just to hear that you're able to now really expand on that and expand on your own knowledge and contribute both to theoretical and but also social conversations, because these are just such intriguing, but more importantly, timely themes that you're looking into. And I imagine the listeners of this show really look forward to hearing more about how your current research unfolds and where it will take you. For now, I want to thank you for putting this time aside and talking to me and talking about your book, Claiming Homes, and talking about your work. I've really enjoyed our conversation. I've learned so much, and I'm sure our listeners have as well. So thank you, Charlotte, and I look forward to hearing more about your research.
Great. Thank you so much, Sylvie. I also really enjoyed this, and it was a pleasure talking to you too, and sort of revisiting and delving into these experiences and elements and so forth that I put forward in writing. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Goodbye.
Bye.